Chapter 19. Lightning Strikes. After Connor's arrival, everyone we knew, with the exception of my very Catholic parents, who were praying for dozens of little Grogans, assumed we were done having children. In the two-income professional crowd in which we ran, one child was the norm, two were considered a bit of an extravagance, and three were simply unheard of. But our two boys brought us more joy than we ever thought anyone or anything possibly could. They defined our life now, and while parts of us missed the leisurely vacations, lazy Saturdays reading novels, and romantic dinners that lingered late into the night, we had come to find our pleasures in new ways, in spilled applesauce and tiny nose prints on window panes, and the soft symphony of bare feet padding down the hallway at dawn. The boys were growing up fast, and each week ended another little chapter that could never again be revisited. One week Patrick was sucking his thumb, the next he had weaned himself of it forever. One week Connor was our baby in a crib, the next he was a little boy using a toddler bed for a trampoline. Patrick was unable to pronounce the L sound, and when women would coo over him, as they often did, he would put his fists on his hips, stick out his lip, and say, "Those yadies are yaffin' at me!" I always meant to get it on videotape, but one day the L's came out perfectly, and that was that. About a year after moving to our new house in Boca, we began trying for our third. Two tries was all it took. Neither of us would admit we wanted a girl, but of course we did, desperately so, despite our many pronouncements during the pregnancy that having three boys would be just great. When on January 9, 1997, Jenny delivered a pink-cheeked 7-pound baby girl whom we named Colleen, our family only now felt like it was complete. If the pregnancy for Connor had been a litany of stress and worry, this pregnancy was textbook perfect, and delivering at Boca Raton Community Hospital introduced us to a whole new level of pampered customer satisfaction. Just down the hall from our room was a lounge with a free all-you-can-drink cappuccino station, so very Boca. By the time the baby finally came, I was so jacked up on frothy caffeine, I could barely hold my hand still to snip the umbilical cord. When Colleen was 1 week old, Jenny brought her outside for the first time. The day was crisp and beautiful, and the boys and I were in the front yard planting flowers. Marley was chained to a tree nearby, happy to lie in the shade and watch the world go by. Jenny sat in the grass beside him and placed the sleeping Colleen in a portable bassinet on the ground between them. After several minutes, the boys beckoned for Mom to come closer to see their handiwork, and they led Jenny and me around the garden beds. We wandered behind some large shrubbery from where we could still see the baby, but passers-by on the street could not see us. As we turned back, I stopped and motioned for Jenny to look out through the shrubs. Out on the street, an older couple walking by had stopped and were gawking at the scene in our front yard with bewildered expressions. Then it hit me. From their vantage point, all they could see was a fragile newborn, alone with a large yellow dog, who appeared to be babysitting single-handedly. The poor couple must have thought they had stumbled on a case of felony child neglect. No doubt the parents were out drinking at a bar somewhere, having left the infant alone in the care of the neighborhood Labrador Retriever. As if he were in on the ruse, Marley, without prompting, shifted positions and rested his chin across the baby's stomach, his head bigger than her whole body, and let out a long sigh as if he were saying, "When are those two going to get home?" We finally stepped out of the bushes and waved to the couple and watched the relief wash over their faces. Thank God that baby hadn't been thrown to the dogs after all. "You must really trust your dog," the woman said somewhat cautiously, betraying a belief that dogs were fierce and unpredictable and had no place that close to a defenseless newborn. "He hasn't eaten one yet," I said. 2 months after Colleen arrived home, I celebrated my 40th birthday in a most inauspicious manner, namely, by myself. The big 4-0 is supposed to be a major turning point. If any birthday merited a blowout celebration, it was the 40th, but not for me. We were now responsible parents with 3 children. Jenny had a new baby pressed to her breast. There were more important things to worry about. I arrived home from work, and Jenny was tired and worn down. After a quick meal of leftovers, I bathed the boys and put them to bed while Jenny nursed Colleen. By 8:30, all 3 children were asleep, and so was my wife. I popped a beer and sat out on the patio, staring into the iridescent blue water of the lit swimming pool. As always, Marley was faithfully at my side, and as I scratched his ears, it occurred to me that he was at about the same turning point in life. We had brought him home 6 years earlier. In dog years, that would put him somewhere in his early 40s now. He had crossed unnoticed into middle age, but still acted every bit the puppy. Except for a string of stubborn ear infections that required Dr. J's repeated intervention, he was healthy. I had never thought of Marley as any kind of role model, but sitting there sipping my beer, I was aware that maybe he held the secret for a good life. Never slow down, never look back, live each day with adolescent verve and spunk and curiosity and playfulness. "Well, big guy," I said, pressing my beer bottle against his cheek in a kind of interspecies toast, "it's just you and me tonight. Here's to 40. Here's to middle age. Here's to running with the big dogs right up until the end." And then he, too, curled up and went to sleep. I was still moping about my solitary birthday a few days later when Jim Tolpin, my old colleague who had broken Marley of his jumping habit, called unexpectedly and asked if I wanted to grab a beer the next night, a Saturday. Jim picked me up at 6 and took me to an English pub where we quaffed Bass Ale and caught up on each other's lives. We were having a grand old time until the bartender called out, "Is there a John Grogan here? Phone for John Grogan." It was Jenny, and she sounded very upset and stressed out. "The baby's crying, the boys are out of control, and I just ripped my contact lens," she wailed into the phone. "Can you come home right away?" "Try to calm down," I said. "Sit tight, I'll be right home." "Come on," Jim said, "I'll drive you." When we turned onto my block, both sides of the street were lined with cars. "Somebody's having a party," I said. I invited Jim inside. When the front door swung open, Jenny didn't look upset at all. In fact, she had a big grin on her face. Behind her stood a bagpipe player in kilts. Good God, what have I walked in on? Then I looked beyond the bagpipe player and saw that someone had taken down the kiddie fence around the pool and launched floating candles on the water. The deck was crammed with several dozen of my friends, neighbors, and co-workers. Just as I was making the connection that all those cars on the street belonged to all these people in my house, they shouted in unison, "Happy birthday, old man!" My wife had not forgotten after all. When I was finally able to snap my jaw shut, I took Jenny in my arms, kissed her on the cheek, and whispered in her ear, "I'll get you later for this." Someone opened the laundry room door looking for the trash can, and out bounded Marley in prime party mode. He swept through the crowd, stole a mozzarella and basil appetizer off a tray, lifted a couple of women's miniskirts with his snout, and made a break for the unfenced swimming pool. I tackled him just as he was launching into his signature running belly flop and dragged him back to solitary confinement. "Don't worry," I said. "I'll save you the leftovers." It wasn't long after the surprise party that Marley finally was able to find validation for his intense fear of thunder. I was in the backyard on a Sunday afternoon under brooding, darkening skies, digging up a rectangle of grass to plant yet another vegetable garden. As I worked, Marley paced nervously around me, his internal barometer sensing an impending storm. I sensed it too, but I wanted to get the project done, and I figured I would work until I felt the first drops of rain. As I dug, I kept glancing at the sky, watching an ominous black thunderhead forming several miles to the east, out over the ocean. Marley was whining softly, beckoning me to put down the shovel and head inside. "Relax," I told him. "It's still miles away." The words had barely left my lips when I felt a previously unknown sensation, a kind of quivering tingle on the back of my neck. The sky had turned an odd shade of olive gray, and the air seemed to go suddenly dead as though some heavenly force had grabbed the winds and frozen them in its grip. Weird, I thought, as I paused, leaning on my shovel to study the sky. That's when I heard it. A buzzing, popping, crackling surge of energy, similar to what you sometimes can hear standing beneath high-tension power lines. A sort of pfff sound filled the air around me, followed by a brief instant of utter silence. In that instant, I knew trouble was coming, but I had no time to react. In the next fraction of a second, the sky went pure, blindingly white, and an explosion, the likes of which I had never heard before, not in any storm, at any fireworks display, at any demolition site, boomed in my ears. A wall of energy hit me in the chest like an invisible linebacker. When I opened my eyes, who knows how many seconds later, I was lying face down on the ground, sand in my mouth, my shovel 10 feet away, rain pelting me. Marley was down too, in his hit-the-deck stance, and when he saw me raise my head, he wiggled desperately toward me on his belly, like a soldier trying to slide beneath barbed wire. When he reached me, he climbed right on my back and buried his snout in my neck, frantically licking me. I looked around for just a second, trying to get my bearings, and I could see where the lightning had struck the power line pole in the corner of the yard and followed the wire down to the house, about 20 feet from where I had been standing. The electrical meter on the wall was in charred ruins. "Come on!" I yelled. And then Marley and I were on our feet, sprinting through the downpour toward the back door as new bolts of lightning flashed around us. We did not stop until we were safely inside. I knelt on the floor, soaking wet, catching my breath, and Marley clambered on me, licking my face. He was beside himself with fear, shaking uncontrollably, drool hanging off his chin. I hugged him, tried to calm him down. "That was close," I said, and realized that I was shaking too. He looked up at me with those big, empathetic eyes that I swore could almost talk. I was sure I knew what he was trying to tell me. "I've been trying to warn you for years that this stuff can kill you, but would anyone listen? Now will you take me seriously?" The dog had a point. Maybe his fear of thunder had not been so irrational after all. Maybe his panic attacks at the first distant rumblings had been his way of telling us that Florida's violent thunderstorms, the deadliest in the country, were not to be dismissed with a shrug. Our house was dark, the air conditioning, ceiling fans, televisions, and several appliances all blown out. The circuit breaker was fused into a melted mess. We were about to make some electrician a very happy man. But I was alive, and so was my trusty sidekick. Jenny and the kids, tucked safely away in the family room, didn't even know the house had been hit. We were all present and accounted for. What else mattered? I pulled Marley into my lap, all 97 nervous pounds of him, and made him a promise right then and there. Never again would I dismiss his fear of this deadly force of nature.